6:05. Good to have you here on a Wednesday. Good morning, Lloyd. How are we?
Good morning, sir. I am well.
Things are not well in the Middle East.
Not well.
Because the hostilities have resumed. We were in a period of cooling.
Yeah, everything was kind of...
Everything seemed to be mostly copacetic.
Yeah.
Talks were happening. We're on the right path to maybe a diplomatic solution with Iran.
Yeah.
Well, yesterday, we heard about these commercial these attacks on commercial tankers in the Strait of Hormuz. In response, CENTCOM launched strikes back against the Iran military targets, like air defense systems, missile sites, assets with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC.
Mm-hmm.
And then the president also revoked this waiver that allowed the sale of Iranian oil. Okay.
Okay.
Well, things are escalating.
Starting to heat up.
Then Iran retaliated. Iran is claiming responsibility for these attacks on U.S. military sites in Kuwait and Bahrain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So all of this is going on while Donald Trump is in Turkey at their annual NATO summit.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump was asked about the memorandum of understanding and where that stands now.
To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. I'll speak to our negotiators. They want to negotiate. They're good people. Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. But they have to come back to me. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. We make a deal. And they were, if I make a deal with him, we have a deal. And he goes out, he talks. We make a deal. Everyone's agreed. No nuclear weapon. We make a deal. They go outside, talk to the press. They say, we never even talked about it. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo. As far as I'm concerned, it's over.
Okay.
So that is changing things, certainly, on the landscape. He was referencing NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte,
yes,
who was next to him, when he said, if we make a deal, it's a deal.
It's a deal.
A deal's a deal, and when I make a deal with him, it's a deal.
Yeah.
Well, Mark Rutte was also asked about this. In particular, the U.S. response to those attacks on those shipping containers,
mm-hmm,
or on the carriers in the Strait of Hormuz. And here's what he had to say.
Well, I think it was absolutely necessary. Because when you have a ceasefire and Iran is basically violating the ceasefire, we've seen what happened yesterday with ships being attacked, I think it is totally crucial that the U.S. forcefully reacts.
Got to do what you got to do. And it's just, you know, it was, to me, I thought it was already, I know we had the ceasefire and we had this deal, you know, 60 days negotiations. But I just always thought you can't trust Iran. You just can't trust them.
No, you can't trust them. And that's... I mean, been clear for a very long time.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you don't go down the path of trying to find that diplomatic solution.
Absolutely. You try. You do it because we're the United States. That's what we do. We do it. But, you know, sometimes, as Mom used to say, you know, hard head makes a soft behind.
Yeah, fair. I mean, yeah.
You know, I mean, hey.
And as a result, we're starting to see oil prices tick up slightly. Brent crude's up to $76 this morning. It was... Like below 70 yesterday.
Yeah.
It was like 65 yesterday.
65 yesterday, yeah.
So that is also in play here as well as we continue to watch. But this is going to escalate.
Oh, definitely. That's
my reading on it, is that this is, if the president is saying, and by the way, I should mention, he did say also that he is going to allow U.S. negotiators to continue to talk to Iran through mediators, mm-hmm, and through intermediaries, and they can continue to go that route. But from his perspective, this thing is done.
A 5-year-old boy is recovering after being struck by a stray bullet last night around 8:50 p.m. He was riding his bicycle outside his home on Detroit's west side near Fargo Oakfield Park, where a teenager, police say, fired several reckless shots into the area. Here's Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison.
5-year-old was out in front of his house riding his bicycle. His father was supervising, and the father heard approximately 3 gunshots, and his child fell from his bicycle. Just to parents and everyone, know where your kids are. Juveniles should not have guns, and whether you're an adult or a child, you should not be firing a weapon inside of the city limits, because what goes up comes down. We talk about it all the time, and we're definitely going to hold the individual accountable.
Now, the boy suffered a through-and-through wound to his arm. He's expected to fully recover. Todd Bettison, the chief, stated that the child was not targeted and that investigators are actively seeking a person of interest described as a 15- to 16-year-old who frequents the area. Mayor Mary Sheffield called the incident a senseless act of violence, emphasizing that every child deserves to feel safe in their neighborhood.
Just indiscriminately just, firing shots?
Just be in the park, and I'll just shoot a gun, and, you know, we'll see what happens. Also, this outbreak that we're dealing with, psychosporiasis. Michigan health officials say the state's psychosporiasis outbreak continues to grow. More than 700 confirmed cases of the parasitic illness. Monroe County has the highest number of infections with 173 cases, followed by Washtenaw and Lenawee counties. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says no specific food source has been identified, although past outbreaks have been linked to contaminated fresh produce. Symptoms usually appear 2 to 14 days after exposure and include frequent watery diarrhea, stomach cramps, bloating, nausea, and low-grade fever. Health officials say anyone experiencing sudden ongoing diarrhea should contact their health care provider or local health department. The illness can be treated with antibiotics, and officials say it does not spread from person to person. But we're going to be talking more about that later on.
Yeah, this hour. And those numbers just continue to tick up and up and up.
Yeah, and usually, I mean, 50 is the norm in Michigan a year, 50 cases.
Yeah.
And we have 700 now.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Pistons have traded Caris LeVert away. This was part of a six-team deal. Chris Middleton goes back to Washington. He's the headline maker here. But Caris LeVert gone as a Piston, no longer will be playing at Little Caesars Arena. And the Pistons able to sign a couple of players. One, certainly we'll know here, but Taurean Prince, one of their power forwards fine signing. Okay. But really what this is doing is making cap space.
That's it.
The other portion of this trade is Gary Harris, former Spartan. Gary Harris is back here in the state of Michigan, played for Milwaukee last, and I think he was drafted by the Nuggets, if I'm not mistaken.
Denver, okay.
After he left Michigan State. But but Gary Harris is now a Piston as well. So what kind of impact they'll have, I don't know. But it is a way to make room for something. What that is, we don't know yet.
Here's
what I'll throw out here.
Okay.
For you tinfoil hatters.
Okay. What do you think?
There have been a number of stories about Kevin Durant.
Oh.
Potentially with these cryptic social media posts signaling that maybe Detroit would be a destination for him. He's good buds with Cade.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. That is a fact.
So, would you like KD here? Not, I don't know. But
oops, I'm sorry. Did I hit that button? So many buttons back here.
I mean, he's at least he's not like, you know, 1,000 years old like LeBron.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's probably
like
not far
900
off.
Then.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I don't
he
know.
Is. He's long
in
the tooth.
I think this team would be better off with more of a team chemistry than just bringing in one big superstar like that. I don't know. I'm not a fan. No thanks.
Okay. And that's why you're not Trajan Langdon.
That's why I do this.
Yeah,
that's right. You're very good at that, too.
Also, Tigers win in their first game with this athletic series 6-2 yesterday down at Comerica Park. Tarek Skubal, he's getting it done. He is getting it done.
Yes.
There it is. There. Can you play the winning streak? I was hoping.
That's called a winning streak.
Mm-hmm. Three in a row.
You know, I hope this isn't our last few starts, we're going to see a Tarek Skubal because I just love him so much. You know, I do. I just love watching him pitch, and I don't want to see him pitch for, like, the Red Sox or Yankees.
Oh, great, because that's exactly what's going to happen.
What a bromance that is over there.
I know. You can feel the heat coming through the glass.
Can't you?
Coming up on the other side, we're talking socialism in America. It's JR Morning. So we've seen it in places like Maine and whether or not Graham Planter is going to continue forward. He's hitting a real bump in that campaign.
He's hitting the wall. Yeah.
I mean, you've got the Bernie Sanders of the world pushing him to drop out of that race.
Mm-hmm.
But we are seeing more socialist candidates across the country, whether that's in Denver, whether that's in New York. And they're winning these primaries against what, I guess some are calling like the Democrat establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Like those that are, and even here in Michigan, right, with Abdul Al-Sayed.
Sayed, yes.
Mm-hmm. Against now just Haley Stevens. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they had a debate last night. We'll get to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there does seem to be some sort of movement in that direction. Why? What's causing it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is becoming a much more prevalent thought. And here in the city of Detroit, we do have a member of the city council that identifies as a Democratic Socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Denzel McCampbell who joins us this morning to talk about it. Denzel, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Great to be on. Thank you all.
I think the last time I talked with you, you were working with Rashida. So it's been years, so it's nice to talk with you again. I'm curious to know what you think, what you're seeing across the country that's leading to more of these candidates having more success, at least in these primaries.
For sure. You know, I will even go back to my race last year. And, you know, my opponents tried to use me being a Democrat Socialist as an attack. But, you know, as I knocked thousands of doors, what we saw and heard from folks again and again was this thought that folks are tired of what has been seen as this catering to corporations and you know, the wealthy in exchange for the needs of working families. And when we think about democratic socialism, you know, folks have used it, you know, a lot of folks have used it as, again, as an attack. But the basis for me is that we are answering the needs and pushing for policies that answer the needs of people, the control of our government for everyday folks and not corporation, the influence of wealthy folks and corporations. That's why you see it's so prevalent and popular for candidates to not take corporate PAC dollars. As you see folks that are pushing for Medicare for All, Medicare for All has consistently polled with high support. We have roads, we have the snow patrol, we have any snow plows, we have fire departments. Those are all aspects of socialized policies, Medicare as well as Social Security. And what we're pushing for is to ensure that, you know, whether it's public education, our health care, our everyday basic needs are about the collective and coming together to answer that as a people and as a government.
Councilman, you know, when people hear the term democratic socialist, many immediately think of communism. Are those two things the same, or is that just a misunderstanding?
You know, I think it is a misunderstanding. There are distinctly different philosophies and views on how society should be set up. And you know, we have democratic socialist countries. You know, we also, as I mentioned, there are policies that we have here in the United States that are on that basis. When we look at Medicare and Social Security, what we came together to say is that we should pool our resources together and ensure that our seniors have health care, to ensure that folks have something as they age in life to ensure that their basic needs are met. So when we think about Medicare for All, we're saying that, okay, right now health care is unaffordable for a vast amount of people. And if you do have health care, is inadequate. So how do we answer that need for our folks to ensure that they have healthy lives? When we think about, again, on the aspect of having that influence of people, we see that there is millions and millions of dollars that are flooding our airways of corporate interest telling folks how to vote and how they should see our elected officials and folks running instead of, you know, people being able to make their own decision in that interaction. So I look at it as a system that really upends this influence that is not in line with people, with the people's needs, and really centers our government for and by of other people.
You know, we've seen these other kind of Marxist, Leninist countries, Soviet Union being one, China being one, where they were largely agrarian, they were impoverished, and the transformation to a socialist platform, It did make them an economic powerhouse. There was a large effort to turn them into a military might, but at the same time, there was cost. There was famine. There was widespread suppression as well. Not to say that that would happen here in the United States, but that's the historical perspective. And then you have like Sweden and Norway. Those are obviously cited often among socialist mm-hmm. Countries where there has been success, but they have strong capitalist tendencies too. So how would you see that working here in the United States?
You know, I think we have the vision and the opportunity to forge our own pathway. Well, I'll say what we have now is that, and you know, this is what I look at, is that we have in the United States a trillionaire now, and we have so much wealth that is concentrated at the top, and yet we still have folks who are unhoused. We still have folks who are having to work multiple jobs just to put food on the table. We still have folks that are even making the cost of living in our country, and I think that is what we have to focus on, is how. We're not saying that folks can't be or should not be wealthy in this country, but what we're also saying is that people should not be going without. We are the richest country on the planet. How do we ensure that our folks are taken care of and have a good quality of life so that they can obtain and attain their what they would like to in life and not be impoverished and be without, and also lead to a shorter life when we think of not being housed, when we think of not having health care, and when we think about this runaway wealth inequality that we have.
We got about 30 seconds left, Councilman, but another issue associated with the Democratic Socialists is defund the police, refund communities. As a Detroit City Council member, what does that actually mean to you?
You know, when I think about, I always frame it as, what does public safety, true public safety look like here in the city of Detroit, in the state of Michigan, across the country? You know, we had recently had a conversation around ShotSpotter here in the city of Detroit. And I look at it as, how are we investing in the preventative side, whether it's around conflict resolution? We know that when our communities are well-resourced around housing, transportation, ensuring that our folks have good-paying, quality jobs, we see crime and violence and harm go down. So as I look at public safety, is ensuring that we also take a look at the preventative side. Mm-hmm. That was my whole thing with ShotSpotter, is that it was a response is not preventative, and I think that's what we should be ensuring that we look at as well.
Denzel McCampbell, thank you so much for your time. Great to talk with you. We'll talk again very soon, I hope.
Absolutely. Take care.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
Interesting. The we'll forge our own path is mm-hmm. what scares me.
Yeah.
Because what does that mean?
What does that
Historically, we know what that path looks like.
Exactly.
What it looks like for us seems like it would be a little different. Get you caught up on some more headlines coming up. It's your morning.
To me, I think it's over.
That's Donald Trump's reaction to these diplomatic talks, the memorandum of understanding. He says he feels that it's over.
Yeah.
Because hostilities have now ramped up again.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And he's going to be meeting with Zelensky today mm-hmm. in Turkey. They're going to be meeting to see what they can do about the deal over there with Russia and Ukraine. Then he's going to speak. He's going to have a press conference, too, around 9:15 this morning. Mm-hmm. Over there. So we'll probably hear more about what he feels about what's going on in Iran.
And that memorandum of understanding, it wasn't a full peace deal. It wasn't a deal.
No.
It was the framework.
It's to get us to a
to the next level
where we can talk
now,
for 60 days.
Right. Again, whether you thought that was right or wrong, I mean, the fact that they almost capitulated to Iran on the nuclear issue, because for the United States and this administration, it's the line is no nuclear weapons.
That's it.
How many times have we heard the president say no nuclear weapons?
Yep.
No nuclear program.
Nope.
Right? Those things.
No enrichment.
Well, mm-hmm. This framework didn't address that, because what Iran wanted was, well, let's stop this war, and then we could talk about the nuclear issue on the other side.
Yeah.
Which we all knew meant that they were just going to kick the can down the road.
As they always do.
And that's what's happened here. So this wasn't a peace treaty. It wasn't a deal. It wasn't a way to end all of this.
Mm-mm. No.
It was, in my mind, a capitulation to the Iranian regime to kick the can down the road.
And for them to get some money, because they're...
Sure, everything.
They were broke, basically.
Yeah, they were losing half $1 billion a day.
Yeah.
So there is that. But then you had the Iranian regime striking commercial tankers in the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm.
The United States responded. They hit air defense systems and the IRGC infrastructure and boats and missile sites and all that stuff. Then the administration had revoked a waiver that allowed some Iranian oil sales to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes down. So you're seeing in real time the breakdown of many of the diplomatic line items that were laid out in the memorandum of understanding.
Yeah.
So the president says, okay, well, this is over. He's not fond of the Iranian regime.
They're liars. They're cheats. They're sick people. They've hurt their people. They killed 54,000 people as of now that were protesting. You know, when people say, how come they haven't taken over? They can't take over because they're dead.
So again, it does draw back into, then what are we doing? What's the objective now? Okay, well, maybe the objective before was, well, let's hit these military sites, let's cripple them militarily, and then they're gonna cower to our demands.
Well, we have crippled them, but not to
we
the
heard
point.
Them.
Yeah, but not to the point where they can't still fire back because they're still firing. At
right,
us.
And then they were hitting Bahrain and Kuwait, and so it feels like we're kind of taking several steps back here.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me.
No, and
with the president saying the things that he is.
But he's also allowing them to continue to negotiate, right? So how does that work is what I want to know. They continue to negotiate, but he says he feels the ceasefire is over. So there could still be more attacks and more bombings on each other while these negotiations are ongoing.
Well, I remember maybe a month ago you said, is it a ceasefire if people are still firing?
Right. I mean,
it doesn't seem like it.
Self-explanatory to me.
This doesn't feel like a ceasefire at this point.
No, absolutely
I mean,
not.
You've got Mark Rutte out here going, well, yeah, the United States absolutely needed to respond. So if Iran is violating the Memorandum of Understanding and the outlines of this ceasefire, and then the United States is responding and violating the outlines of the ceasefire, well, then what are we doing?
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I think, where the president has landed.
Yeah.
It almost, you know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like he's almost just resigned to the fact that there's going to be more military action.
Oh, no. That's what it sounded like. That's what it sounds like. Yeah.
Like, now,
I'm tired.
We'll see.
I don't want to deal with them anymore. Right. They're crazy. Whatever.
Right.
You know.
Time will tell.
Yeah.
Time will tell. But it's a demoralizing couple of steps backwards.
The race for Michigan's Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate took center stage last night as the candidates, Abdul El-Sayed and Haley Stevens, faced off in their first one-on-one televised debate since State Senator Mallory McMorrow dropped out of the primary. The contest features sharp divide between El-Sayed, a progressive critic of U.S. policy toward Israel, and Stevens, a suburban Detroit congresswoman who supports continued military aid to Israel. The candidates clashed over immigration, campaign funding, and foreign policy. El-Sayed called for abolishing ICE, arguing the agency has become a militarized force, while Stevens said the system needs reform and defended her record on national security issues. Stevens highlighted her efforts to help free former Michigan resident Paul Whelan from a Russian prison, while also accusing El-Sayed of relying on Republican-style attacks. The two also sparred over Israel and outside spending in the race, with El-Sayed criticizing millions of dollars in support for Stevens from pro-Israel groups. Stevens accused El-Sayed of benefiting from Republican efforts to influence the primary. The winner of the August Democratic primary will face Republican Mike Rogers in November.
Yeah, the AIPAC issue was
big deal.
One of the big issues of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly. And I thought Haley Stevens, the way she positioned herself, like, I get the job done. You just want to go around to the media.
Yeah.
Like, you want to be the celebrity. I'm going to do the work.
I'm going to do the work. Yeah.
You know, and that, I think, resonates more with Michiganders more so than
the pomp and circumstances.
Yeah.
The bright lights. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, and this is where it's why I bring up Colorado and Maine and New York. All of these states where there are socialist candidates doing well, I bring that up because we are seeing that here. We are seeing somebody who has those. I mean, he's talking Medicaid for Medicare for all.
Yes,
this is what socialists are in for,
and
so it's why I bring those up, because I'm interested in the contrast of, well, Michigan is not Colorado.
No,
Michigan is not New York.
Mm-mm.
Michigan is not Maine.
Mm-mm.
So how does that play here? And I don't think it plays as well here. Again, right now what we're seeing are these candidates trying to win voters in their own parties. Abdul El-Sayed isn't yet trying to get Republicans on his side.
No.
He's trying to win a heated primary.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to get enough votes for Democrats,
right,
against a Democrat to get
to
Mike Rogers.
To November, yes.
So he's not even, they're not there yet.
No.
Okay. Now, Haley Stevens, she's an incumbent, so she's got to, she can speak on that a little more.
Yes.
But It's a lot different for Abdul Al-Sayed, and I just don't think that that – now, I could be totally wrong.
Well, listen, we have a city council person who is, you know, a socialist.
Yeah, but you're dealing with one city.
Yeah.
And it's a big city.
It's
a big city.
It's a big city.
But you're dealing with one city. You're not dealing with an entire state of voters.
No.
So it's a little different. The scale is different.
Yeah, I think the scale is different, but I, you know, out of all the cities, I didn't know if Detroit would have been the one that would put someone in, but
Again, I mean, all these different neighborhoods, I mean, you know, different neighborhoods think differently and different areas think differently.
Yeah.
So it's
because he's in the district. I mean, the council person is the district. So he, you know, he's
correct.
The district.
So that's who he's getting votes from.
Exactly. It wasn't state. I mean, citywide.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's why I bring up those other areas, because how is that a contrast to what we're seeing here? There is an exact example here. And I don't think that plays with Michigan voters. Now, again, I could eat crow.
Well,
I'm giving you carte blanche and our listeners carte blanche. Listen. To go, Chris, you were incredibly wrong.
No, I felt that way, too, when what happened in New York happened in the other places. I said, no, this couldn't – I don't think it would happen here in Michigan. But I'm like you. I could be wrong. But I continue to feel like I don't think it could happen here in Michigan. But we could be wrong.
The cyclosporiasis outbreak is worsening here in Michigan. We're going to talk about that on the other side. It's JR Morning. Well, this parasitic gastrointestinal illness, cyclosporiasis – those numbers here in the state of Michigan that people have contracted up to 700, according to the state health agency. And I remember last week when we talked about this, the idea here or the hypothesis is that this was coming from produce that people haven't been washing properly, because that's what it has been in the past.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so why is it spreading the way that it is? Is this worse this time around than in years past? Let's talk about it. Dr. Tina Chopra, the professor of medicine at Wayne State University School of Medicine, joins us to talk about it. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
What is causing this to be so much worse this year? I mean, these cases are not uncommon in the past, but the numbers are skyrocketing.
Yeah, like you already pointed out, you know, it's contaminated produce. That's what we've seen in the past. But, you know, it's possible that it is summer. People are, you know, consuming more fruits and vegetables, fresh vegetables, salads, you know, all these different items, consumption of these items can cause it. And usually it is more in the summer months. Also, the other reason could be that we don't know exactly so far. You know, we haven't been able to pinpoint which produce is causing it. And as you know, the distribution can be a problem, or some states are producing it, some are distributing it. The problem can be anywhere during, you know, agricultural sanitation is also very important, because this parasite, the only host for this parasite is humans, and it's contaminated produce, which is from water, which is, you know, contaminated with human fecal matter. And that's how it, you know, gets onto the produce and then comes to the consumers.
Dr. Chopra, how soon after someone is exposed to this parasite do symptoms usually begin? I mean, could someone have picked it up over the 4th of July weekend and not even know it yet?
You are absolutely right. It takes about a week after eating contaminated food, and sometimes even up to 2 weeks. So anywhere between 2 days to up to 2 weeks. Most people cannot even remember every salad or herb or berry or restaurant meal that they ate days earlier.
Mm. Have we been able to track this down to a specific type of food, a specific type of produce, or a specific grower?
Not so far, you know, because fresh produce is distributed widely. And so one contaminated farm or packing facility can affect many states, but they haven't been able to pinpoint. The other reason is the parasite is very difficult to detect in food, which makes lab confirmation challenging. There is recall bias associated with when you interview 700 people, some people may not remember. And going back in time, there is a lot of bias involved. So all these challenges make it harder to figure it out.
Is this one of those illnesses, doctor, that simply just has to run its course, or is there medications that can treat it?
There are antibiotics that are available, and they are very effective. So if somebody is suffering, they are having diarrhea, they have symptoms, they must contact their healthcare provider so they can test them for cyclosporiasis. There is a specific test that can be done, and there is a specific antibiotic called Bactrim that can be given to patients, and it's highly effective.
Mm. How does this differ from, for example, like you hear it when you go to Mexico, you shouldn't drink the water there.
The norovirus order.
Is this a similar type of bug that you would contract in maybe other tropical climates?
Now, that's a great question. It's not very similar to those. Cyclospora is a parasite. It's a microscopic parasite. And it has a very long, as you know, other cases of foodborne illnesses or food poisoning, for example, happens right after consumption of meal, you know, within hours. It is sometimes due to toxins, sometimes due to a virus, whereas here it takes up to a week or up to 2 weeks. The other difference is it cannot be transmitted from humans to humans. Mm-hmm. Norovirus can be transmitted from one person to another through contaminated hands and et cetera. But this cannot be transmitted from humans to humans. A person who is suffering from this, from cyclosporiasis, will pass the parasite in their stool, and then the parasite has to complete its life cycle in the environment before it is ready to infect somebody else through again the produce. So it has a life cycle that it must complete outside of the human body in the environment before it can infect somebody else through produce again.
You know, we've got about a minute left, doctor. 36 people have already been hospitalized. Who is most at risk for developing serious complications from this infection?
Yeah, usually the vulnerable, where, you know, very young and very old, you know, with compromised immune systems, immunocompromised patients, those are the ones that we are seeing in the hospital getting sicker than, you know, others. So people who don't have strong immunities, you know, our elderly patients, our immunocompromised patients, et cetera, are being hospitalized.
Dr. Tina Chopra, thank you for your insight as always. We appreciate it. We'll talk again very soon, hopefully with some better medical news to talk about.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you got it. That's it, Lloyd. I've made up my mind. No more fruits and vegetables.
No, oh, come on.
Just no more. No
You're
more?
Done? You're done?
I'm done. I don't want to do it.
If you buy it, I don't want it. Now, going out to eat sometimes, you know, you don't know if they're following the procedure that you're supposed to follow for the lettuce and all that. So, yeah, okay, maybe going out to eat, maybe you cut back on that. But if you're doing it yourself, you know what you need to do, and you just do it.
I can't do it.
You didn't want to anyway. That's the problem. You just got an excuse.
I don't want it. I don't want to get sick.
Oh, you just needed an excuse so you don't have to eat your veggies.
I guess it's, you know, buddies for dinner. I don't know. That's crazy. I don't want to get sick.
Okay.
That's what I said back here. I said, if everything's bad for you, I'm just going to have pizza for the rest of my life.
That's exactly right.
Oh, my God.
Jason's on it. 7 o'clock hour coming up. Get you caught up on the headlines. It's JR Morning.
Well, I think it was absolutely necessary because when you have a ceasefire, and Iran is basically violating the ceasefire. We've seen what happened yesterday with ships being attacked. I think it is totally crucial that the U.S. forcefully reacts.
That is NATO General Secretary Mark Rutte on the military response by the United States after Iran targeted these tankers in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah.
And so as a result, the United States CENTCOM announced that they had hit different military infrastructure, the IRGC, as a retaliatory strike. They called it an offensive strike, which is different from past retaliatory strikes that CENTCOM has commented on, where they've called them defensive.
Yeah.
So a bit of a different delivery for CENTCOM in their breakdown of the response.
Well, this was supposed to be, you know, a ceasefire and then 60 days of negotiations until we can, you know, get something done. I mean, the bottom line that the president says, no nuclear weapons, no enriched uranium. And then Iran just decides, oh, I'm just going to shoot some tankers in the streets. I'm just going to do it. Now, we've already said we're stopping. Cease. Nope. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to shoot.
Why do you think they're doing it?
I don't know. I don't know if somebody just woke up one day and said, hey, let's just start shooting at the tankers.
Yeah, it feels like a blatant
exactly violent.
Like they know what the United States is going to do.
Yes.
And they're going to respond militarily.
Mm-hmm.
And again, here's where I think Donald Trump messed up, is because when the Memorandum of Understanding was signed and accepted, the president talked about not wanting the country to go into a depression.
That's right.
Because of high gas prices, mm-hmm. you know, the economic outlook was changing, mm-hmm. inflation was rising, things like that. And now you kind of give the house away.
Yeah.
And that's not something you can do when you're trying to, A, negotiate with the country, or B, when there are other options on the table, like further military action.
And, you know, he's saying that he's going to allow his people to continue with the negotiations, but how do you really do that if they're still firing at each other?
Well, he says he feels like the memorandum of understanding at this point is non-existent.
To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. I'll speak to our negotiators. They want to negotiate. They're good people. Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. But they have to come back to me. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. We make a deal. And they were, if I make a deal with him, we have a deal. And he goes out, he talks. We make a deal. Everyone's agreed. No nuclear weapon. We make a deal. They go outside, talk to the press. They say, we never even talked about it. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo. As far as I'm concerned, it's over.
Hmm. Okay. Pretty strong comments by the president.
I mean, you can't get any more descriptive
than
that. Wayne State University says it's aware of online threats allegedly made by Kyle W. Brown targeting the university and other entities. The school has released Brown's photo as law enforcement works to locate him. Wayne State says its police department is working with other agencies in search of this person, and out of an abundance of caution has increased security across campus. Now, university officials have not released details about the nature of the threats, but are urging the campus community to remain alert as the investigation continues.
Mm. So
it's kind of vague there, but I guess they're saying, you know, watch out for this guy. If you know where he is, let us know. But he's making some threats against the university, and just be vigilant until we get him.
Yeah. Pistons also trade Caris LeVert away, and that means that they are freeing up more cap space. They do get Gary Harris, the former Michigan State sharpshooter. He's back. And they also get a power forward, so they'll have that available as well. But this move was more about cap space.
Does that mean we're going to get a big-name person in here?
I don't know. All I'll say is this, is why would you be freeing up cap space?
Yeah.
If you feel like this roster is where it needs to be going into the season.
No.
I just don't buy it.
Mm-mm.
There's something else happening here.
No, it's It's definitely a method to their madness.
Yeah, probably.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like Kevin Durant is on social media wearing like a Detroit hat, or, you know, just like some subtle things. Like, why is Kevin Durant? But he and Cade Cunningham are good friends.
Yeah.
So maybe that's, you know, a little bit of a sweetener here is, you know, you get to come play with Cade. Cade, one of the, you know, best up and rising players in the league.
Yeah. And you have a team that really is on the verge of possibly winning a championship. And so, you know, if you want to try to win another championship before you call it quits, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty good. Tigers also win yesterday. Maybe I should turn my computer volume off. Tigers win yesterday 6-2. They beat the Athletics down at Comerica Park. Tarik Skubal, 5 innings pitched, 5 hits, 1 earned run, 9 strikeouts. two walks in that outing. Here's AJ Hinch.
He battled. You know, they did make him work. Those were some pretty intense innings, and he came out hot. I mean, at the beginning of the game, three punch to start to set the tone, and he did get a lot of miss and just ran that pitch count up a little bit with some foul balls laid, and he had to get into battle mode. So it was nice to see our guys play some good defense behind him. He's the hardest critic on himself, because if he's not perfect, he beats himself up quite a bit. And to give him some grace, I mean, this guy's going out, and where one run is sort of deemed like, an okay outing. Like, think about that standard every time you take the mound, where no matter what you do, it's the bar is really high.
Yeah, when you win back-to-back Cy Youngs, that's the expectation,
mm-hmm.
is you're going to go out there and dominate, and he largely has.
And let's hope he continues.
Yeah.
That's called a winning streak.
That's right.
Yes, it is.
Keith goes yards. That's right. We'll take a break. Coming up on the other side, the U.S. death rate is at its low in 2025, or since 2025. Why is that? We'll discuss. But first, at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, a spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. As published in GameDeveloper.com, one thing consumers refuse to give up on or cut back on, in spite of how challenging the economy may be, is engaging in and spending on digital games. The total consumer spending on games topped $60 billion in the U.S. in 2025. That, according to a latest report by the Entertainment Software Association, ESA, as they're known. And it's important to note that these surveys were conducted by YouGov in February of this year with 13,545 total respondents. And cutting right to the bottom line, here's a mind-blowing stat that makes clear just how well this category is doing, as shown in the 2026 Essential Facts about the U.S. Video Game Industry Report. Video games are outpacing consumer spending on movies, TV, and music content combined. Sourced via Circana, the total figure amounts to $60.7 billion. This is made up of about $52.3 billion spent on content, $5.4 billion spent on hardware, and $2.95 billion spent on accessories. The figure is almost as high as 2021, the year with the highest spending this far, at $61.7 billion on our gaming addictions. There you have it, an industry healthy, to say the least. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, so new CDC provisional data shows that in 2025, the U.S. death rate fell to a record low, under 690 deaths per 100,000 people. It's a 4.6% decline from 2024. It's the lowest ever recorded in the country. Why is that? Well, let's talk about it. Arlene Geronimus is a professor of health and behavior and health equity at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan and joins us. Professor, it's good to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So this is provisional data, which is important to mention here. And this is all great news, but why? Why are we seeing such a precipitous drop here?
Well, I'm not sure we are, is the answer. And I'm sorry to douse cold water on what should be very good news. And if it holds up, it will be good news. But there's a variety of reasons to think this particular report could be being interpreted in a misleading way. The first one is they're comparing it just to 1 year. They're comparing 2 years. And we've studied mortality rates in the country over the last 40 years. And what you really have to see is not year-to-year differences, but you need to see trends. So if this continues, that would be good news, but it's not good news yet. Also, they say they use different methodologies in 2024 and 2025, but they don't give details. And so it's possible that there is no difference, or that the difference even goes in the other direction until we know what those different methodologies. We don't know if we're comparing apples to oranges. I think it's more likely we're comparing Granny Smith apples to Macintosh apples, but they're not exactly the same, so you really can't make statements. But what I would stress the most is that These are overall rates. And what we've seen in the country over the last, say, 20 years is that some Americans are experiencing increasing longevity and others are experiencing either stagnation or even losing years of life compared to the past. So until they break this down by, you know, metropolitan versus rural, by especially socioeconomic status, income, education, we can't be sure whether this is just another expression of some of the very big inequities we have in the country in terms of income, in terms of wealth, in terms of access to health care. We've seen especially working class white Americans have been seeing their mortality rates go up, not down. And there's no way to see in this data whether that's still happening or not. So I think people need to, as much as it would be wonderful if this turned out to be an accurate reporting or interpretation of the statistics, I think we have to exercise caution. And the last part is, while it will be wonderful if the U.S. does better than it's done before, it's so far behind other wealthy countries and even middle-income countries in some cases in terms of our death rate. So it's a little too early to party.
Professor, you know, when people hear record low death rate, you know, I think many may assume that Americans are healthier than ever. Is that the right conclusion, or is the story a little bit more complicated?
The story's definitely more complicated. There's no evidence we're healthier or that on average or across the board healthier. Again, we have some people who have, you know, access to all the resources they need, to all the, you know, clean air and environmental help they need, to medical care that's, you know, as good as any in the world, if not better. And then there are others who have barriers to all of those things and are lacking resources. And those resources also are being taken away, some Medicaid cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Closing of rural hospitals is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
So people in certain pockets of the country, I would be surprised to find that their longevity has increased or that their mortality rate has decreased if we could break them out from the other people. So I think this is giving us a little bit of, or maybe not even a little bit, it's hard to know whether it's a little bit or a very big misleading impression.
Well, some of the good news, though, again, in this preliminary report is that they show less suicide deaths. They show less overdose deaths. So those things where maybe something could be prevented that's outside of the physical healthcare system, that we're seeing good trends there.
Yeah, I hope that, yes, I don't want to suggest there's no good trends in this or nothing to be happy about here. But at the same time, these are provisional data, and you could turn that around a little and just say that we've lost so many people in the last, say, 5 years to COVID and or even 10 years to the opioid epidemic, that part of this may just be that we've, you know, there's not people left to die from.
Right, we've returned to the median.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would be very cautious and certainly not read this as we're definitely going in the right directions or doing the right things or it's going to keep getting better. That remains to be seen. And my guess is, knowing the major drivers in general of deaths, I mean, the cancer rates and the cardiovascular disease rates, they are still the number one and two causes of death by a very huge margin. And we're not seeing any reason to believe those would go down. People, you know, a lot of access to healthcare has been cut, access to information, vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
People's lives are actually more stressful now, and that often is a
what?
Precursor to cardiovascular.
That can't be true, Professor.
Yes, I'm sorry to say. I'm really, truly sorry to say.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
those things
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the report did say that there were certainly some limitations to those findings. Hopefully we are comparing Granny Smiths to Granny Smiths, and it is going to be good news on the other side. Professor Arlene Geronimus, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. And the report did say some of those limitations, the provisional data, the timelines of death certificate submissions, race categories may have been misclassified, the methodology of the population. So there are some shortcomings.
There's some shortcomings, but, you know, we'll see. We'll just keep an eye on it.
An effort to stop bipartisan training. Music to my ears. It's next, the JR Morning.
They're liars. They're cheats. They're sick people. They've hurt their people. They killed 54,000 people as of now that were protesting. You know, when people say, how come they haven't taken over? They can't take over because they're dead.
That's the president yesterday reacting to the Iranian regime and the decision by the United States to retaliate against Iran, who were attacking ships in the Strait of Hormuz. And the president basically has said he feels like the ceasefire is over.
It's done.
The memorandum of understanding is over, and that he's finding that it's very difficult to negotiate with the Iranians. And that dominated much of the conversation around NATO yesterday. Let's talk about the latest with Jonathan Savage. He's in Turkey covering the NATO meetings for Fox News and, of course, for WJR. Jonathan, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Hello. Good morning. Nice to talk to you again.
Fireworks yesterday, huh?
Yeah, it's yesterday and today. It has certainly been a notable start, a notable summit. As a summit that was meant to focus on European defense spending and meeting President Trump's demand to shift the burden. But instead, it's been overshadowed by the conflict in Iran and, to an extent, by the president airing once again his long-held grievances towards European partners. But yet today, there's no doubt that President Trump caught everyone's attention when he said, as far as he's concerned, the ceasefire in Iran is over. It still technically exists. Negotiators are still in contact, but President Trump sounds like he's mentally walked away from this. He said they can talk, but I think they're wasting their time. A series of insults towards Iran's leaders, scum, sick people, liars, and cuckoo. So, things don't necessarily look good for hopes of peace in Iran.
And I'm wondering also, you know, he said that they could still negotiate, you know, his negotiators could still negotiate, but how do you continue to do that when, you know, they're firing at each other? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, there's an extent to which the exchange of fire is limited and contained. This is the second time this has happened recently. Iran allegedly fired its ships in the Strait of Hormuz. The United States said, that's not allowed. We are going to bomb you. We're going to strike you, your assets on the coast of the Strait of Hormuz. And then Iran fired missiles and drones at U.S. military bases in Kuwait and Bahrain. Second time this has happened. The first time it was almost a bit of a bop on the nose to say, hold on, steady on. We can come back and fight you if you keep going. This time appears to be more serious. But President Trump is leaving the door slightly open by saying that his negotiators can continue to talk.
You mentioned a bit of the grievances that is being held towards some European countries, including Spain. The president had slammed the country for not contributing enough to NATO, certainly from the defense perspective. Also, I think still the idea that they were not allowing the United States to use their military bases as a jumping off point in this Iran conflict. And the United States imports roughly up to $21 billion a year of goods from Spain, which is machinery and pharmaceuticals and agricultural products for the most part. But he says that we should cut off all trade with Spain.
He does. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that because Spain is part of the European Union, right, and the European Union negotiates as a single block, single entity. So it's not like you can immediately cut off all trade with Spain. I think that is... he has said this before, actually, and nothing really happened. And the Spanish, they are treating this as just a continuation of the status quo. But we may see some sort of sanctions or something happening regarding Spain from the United States. We wait to see what the Treasury Department does. But he's clearly very upset with Spain. He said they're hopeless, they're bad people, and they're a terrible partner. So not quite as strong words as the ones he had for Iran, but not very friendly nonetheless.
Jonathan, President Trump says he believes Russia and Ukraine both want a deal. He's going to be meeting with President Zelensky today. What's at stake in that conversation?
Well, quite a lot for Ukraine. They want more missiles for their Patriot air defenses, the U.S.-made Patriots. That's really important to Ukraine because Russia has stepped up its aerial assaults on the country enormously. 50 people killed, more than that in the last week. Apartment blocks being reduced to the partial rubble, and this is Russia's continuation of its aerial assault at an even greater scale. So there's a call for more air defenses. President Zelensky also raised once again the idea of Ukraine joining NATO. In the past, NATO would say, your place is in here, is in our club, you will join us one day. That is very much on the back burner since President Trump came to power and essentially said that he wouldn't allow it. But Vladimir Zelensky is saying yesterday, look, we've got such great armed forces, we're so experienced at everything you need to be experienced in, why wouldn't you let us join?
Greenland also back in the mix too.
Revive that conversation.
Yeah, Lou was right at the end of his press availability yesterday, and someone just had to ask him about Greenland. I think that it's left a lot of politicians in Europe banging their heads on the desk. This was meant to be swept aside at the Davos meeting earlier this year when NATO countries sort of agreed an action plan for ensuring Greenlandic security, stepping up Arctic security, and easing President Trump's concerns. They don't appear to have been eased. He said once again the US should control Greenland. Now, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen is here. She was asked about it, obviously. She said Greenland's not for sale. She was asked, are you ready to militarily defend Greenland? She said, we are ready to defend every inch of NATO, including our own territory.
I know the president argues that Greenland is surrounded by Russian and Chinese military activity. Is there legitimate national security concerns, though, behind those comments, even if allies disagree with, you know, his proposed solution?
Yeah, and there's dispute over the extent to which Greenland is crawling with Russian and Chinese naval assets. This is part of NATO territory. NATO is already doing its best to control the waters there. There's certainly a legitimate reason why the United States should have an interest in Greenland. Why should have an interest in Greenlandic security? It is the shortest way, really, from Russia to many parts of the United States. And it's certainly somewhere where Russia and China would love to have economic and military superiority. But what NATO's challenge is to convince President Trump that this can all happen with the status quo, with Greenland remaining part of Denmark and NATO having a significant presence there.
Jonathan Savage, appreciate your reporting on this. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, you got it. Interesting stuff coming out of Turkey.
I'm telling you, you know, you go for one thing and it ends up being something else, you know.
Congresswoman Kristen McDonald Rivett joins us on the other side. She's leading a bipartisan effort to stop insider trading amongst public officials.
You've been talking about that a long time, man.
I love it. We'll talk to her coming up on the other side. But first, yes, we have come over at least some of the hot spell here in Michigan, but that doesn't mean that we're through. And we like to be outside having fun, but these high temperatures should never break your budgets. That's why you need to count on Consumers Energy to help make the most of this season and stretch your budget with tips and way to save, like shifting some energy use to the morning or the evening, or raising your thermostat just a couple of degrees. Laundry, you got to do that. We'll do it in the evening or on the weekends. All these things actually help lower your bill and keep your home comfortable. So discover those ways to save and beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer. So a number of members of Congress, including Michigan Congresswoman Kristen McDonald Rivett, they are introducing the No Profiting from Public Service Act. It was just introduced at the end of June. It would ban politicians, Supreme Court justices, other federal officials from trading stocks and using prediction markets to wager on government and politics. I have been saying for quite some time,
yes, I
believe members of Congress, I believe government officials, I think you should carry clear see-through folders so we can see everything that's going on. Transparency is huge. Mm-hmm. But then the ability to put a halt to the information that they are privy to and how that impacts the way that they grow their portfolio. I love this idea. Kristen McDonald Rivett, the congressman out of Mid-Michigan, joins us this morning to talk about it. Congresswoman, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning.
Where did this come from? We've seen similar bills pop up before, never been a ton of support. What maybe is different about this piece of legislation?
Well, I think that most Americans agree with you. Things should be transparent. Members should not be individually trading stocks. A really obvious thing. It's unbelievable that it has not passed Congress, but I think we actually have We've got a good bipartisan group on this bill to actually get it to move. But the thing I thought was incredibly important to add is not just not trading on the stock market, but you can't trade on the prediction markets, which are, you know, this growing thing that a lot of people don't really understand. But essentially, you can bet on anything on a prediction market, including whether tariffs come up and down, when military strikes are going to happen, who's going to win an election. All of those things, members of Congress, the executive branch, our judges have access to inside information. It's illegal for everybody else in the country. It should absolutely be illegal for the people who run to be public servants.
And some critics will argue that people shouldn't have to give up their investment portfolio simply because they chose to serve their country. What's your response?
I mean, this is public service, keyword there, service. You can't, you know, in the same way you can't insider trade on the stock market, you can't sit in a room where the decision is being made about whether or not to allow a company to merge, whether or not we're going to engage in a military strike, whether and then go in with that information and make money. We see people right now at the executive level and in Congress that will make a single bet on the prediction market that earns them more money than people in Michigan make in a year. That's just the deal. We've reached a point where people don't trust public servants anymore. They don't trust elected officials anymore. So that's going to take a long time to clean up because there's a lot of stuff to clean up. But what we can do is start with this, which is an incredibly obvious thing to do. I just feel like it's really important that we extend it to the executive, to the judicial, and honestly, on prediction markets, it should be extended to candidates as well. Federal candidates cannot go to a prediction market and make a bet on whether or not they're going to win or lose a race when they have information about inside polling information that nobody else gets to see.
Yeah.
This is basic.
No, I completely agree. And, like, I'm different. I like to watch C-SPAN because I like to watch the committee hearings that you guys are on. I understand most people aren't like that. Uh-huh. It can be a little tedious at times. But what the information that you and others, and I'm not accusing, obviously, but the information that lawmakers get can be incredibly beneficial based on different government contracts that are going out. And all of a sudden, a stock is going to be more valuable when this deal is signed. So that information, I completely agree. I don't think lawmakers should be doing that. Is there a specific instance that you look back to and said, well, wait a second, why is this so out of whack? Why is this happening? Is there something that led you to want to get on a bill like this?
Yeah, I mean, I actually authored this bill. So it was a much stronger thing for me to be able to, I just really, there's example after example after example. But let me tell you, one member of Congress that came in my class, so this is his first term in Congress, 3,000 trades, individual trades, in his first year. Listen, I don't know how he even has time to do his job, but when you're making 3,000 individual trades and you with information, what you see on C-SPAN, I'm glad you watch. You're probably one of four people, but I'm glad you watch. but what you don't hear is the information that we get in the private briefings. You don't see the research and privileged information that comes across our desks. When you're using that to make these trades, you're using your office for benefit, for your own personal wealth benefit. That is antithetical to everything this country stands for, and we have to stop. Now, I also think that we need to do a lot more. I think we need a enforceable code of ethics for our Supreme Court and clean that up. We need a conflict of interest policy for the executive. All of these things that most of us face in our day-to-day lives that just don't apply to federal elected officials. We have to actually completely change that because we can't have people making decisions about whether or not their portfolio is going to grow when most people are worrying about whether or not they can keep the lights on.
And another interesting aspect of this bill is that it also covers spouses and dependent children. Why include the family members?
Because it prevents a workaround. You can't, you know, the member of Congress, it allows, if you don't do that, you can just pass on the information to your kids or your child and have them make those bets and those investments in their name, but it still enriches the family wealth. You know, it's just too close to the principle.
Keep us updated on this, please. I think this is a really important piece of legislation, and would love to hear how this thing finishes out.
Absolutely.
Yep, you got it. That's Congresswoman Kristen McDonald-Rivett. Appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much. Have a great day.
You got it. You do the same.
Boy, you were waiting for this one. But we've talked about
because,
this.
Look,
I mean, it's, yeah.
Like, the realities are money corrupts.
Uh-huh.
And when you have information to all of it, and it's why these people that leave office, they come in, they're like, yeah, I owned a pipe fitting company.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had $200,000 in the bank when I got elected. Now I'm worth $40 million.
Yes,
again,
exactly.
I ain't a mathematician,
uh-huh.
but on a $175,000 a year salary, I don't quite understand.
The math ain't mathin'.
And you've been in Congress for 16 minutes. Got it. Like, that stuff is crazy to
it
me.
It is.
But, like, people are like, oh, look at Donald Trump. And it's like, look at him. Look at all of you. Mm-hmm. Everybody's throwing stones in a glass house.
That's it.
I don't like any of it. And again, if you take that away, all of a sudden you start going back, you roll back the clock and go like, oh, yeah, people used to serve their country because they wanted to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. And not because they wanted to get rich.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Enrich themselves quickly.
That's
exactly right. 8 o'clock hour coming up. Lots to do. Absentee ballots are out and about. Have we heard enough from those running for office here in the state of Michigan? That and a whole heck of a lot more. It's JR Morning. All right. So the president at NATO seems to indicate that at least in his mind, the ceasefire with Iran is over. And this comes after a period of relative calm. Negotiations were ongoing. There was travel flowing through the Strait of Hormuz.
Gas prices were dropping.
The cost of a barrel of oil was dropping. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Iran starts firing on commercial tankers in the Strait. U.S. CENTCOM confirmed that they launched strikes against Iran and military targets, air defense systems, missile sites, IRGC facilities and assets. And then the administration revoked a waiver to allow Iranian to sell some of their oil. And then Iran returns and fires on Kuwait and Bahrain.
Mm-hmm.
And now the president says he feels like the memorandum of understanding is no more.
To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people. And if they had a nuclear weapon, they'd use it. As far as I'm concerned, it's over. I'll speak to our negotiators. They want to negotiate. They're good people. Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. But they have to come back to me. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. We make a deal. And if I make a deal with him, we have a deal. And he goes out, he talks. We make a deal. Everyone's agreed. No nuclear weapon. We make a deal. They go outside, talk to the press. They say, we never even talked about it. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo. As far as I'm concerned, it's over.
Well, one of the reasons why Iran does that is because they're trying to uphold an image in their own country.
Absolutely.
If they start talking like that, then all of a sudden you lose your grip on power. And those people that want to be out of the heel of this oppressive regime, they all of a sudden it gives them a green light. And they haven't been given that.
And I always wondered, too, you know, who are we? Are we talking to the right people? Are we talking to the ones who can make these things happen? Because it just seems like we talked, we had this ceasefire, and then somebody just woke up one day and said, oh, I'm just going to fire this, you know, missile into the Straits and hit some tankers. Just going to do it.
I don't know. It doesn't feel that way.
It doesn't.
It feels much more calculated.
Yeah, well.
Because Iran has shown that they can weather the storm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Now, doesn't mean they like it.
No.
Doesn't mean they like the Strait being closed.
But their tolerance for pain is pretty high.
It was much higher than maybe we anticipated. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the president capitulated.
Because
he's the one who said, look, I don't want to go into a depression here.
That's exactly.
And again, the political ramifications are so much higher here that all of a sudden he's staring down the barrel of potentially losing the midterms, which I think at this point you're losing the House. But regardless,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at all of these external factors and saying, well, we can't do this forever. And now you've gone down the diplomatic route. Now you're saying that that's not going to work.
Yeah. So you're dealing with a regime that you know, never keeps its word.
Correct. So now what do you do? Mark Rutte, the general secretary of NATO, said that the United States was certainly within their rights to respond to Iran.
Well, I think it was absolutely necessary because when you have a ceasefire and Iran is basically violating the ceasefire, and we've seen what happened yesterday with ships being attacked, I think it is totally crucial that the U.S. forcefully react.
There's a lot of other things that they have to get to.
Oh, yeah.
In Turkey at this summit.
A lot of.
But this is now dominated yesterday and certainly this morning.
A 5-year-old boy recovering after being struck by a stray bullet last night about 8:50 while he was riding his bike outside of his home on Detroit's west side near Fargo Oakfield Park when a teenager police say fired several reckless shots into the area. Here's Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison.
5-year-old was out in front of his house riding his bicycle. His father was supervising and the father heard approximately 3 gunshots. And his child fell from his bicycle. Just to parents and everyone, know where your kids are. Juveniles should not have guns, and whether you're an adult or a child, you should not be firing a weapon inside of the city limits, because what goes up comes down. We talk about it all the time, and we're definitely going to hold the individual accountable.
Now, the boy suffered a through-and-through wound to his arm. He's expected to fully recover. Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison stated that the child was not targeted, and that investigators are actively seeking a person of interest described as a 15 to 16-year-old who frequents the area. Mayor Mary Sheffield called the incident a senseless act of violence, emphasizing that every child deserves to feel safe in their neighborhood. Anyone with information urged to call Crime Stoppers 1-800-SPEAK-UP. This person, 15 or 16 years old, who frequents the area, police say, just wanted to shoot a gun and started to shoot a gun in the area. And this kid, this 5-year-old, was innocent, riding his bike up and down the street in front of his house while his dad was on the porch watching him, and he gets hit by a stray bullet.
Mm.
So
thank God he'll be okay.
He'll be fine.
Yeah.
He'll be fine. But, yeah, I mean, you know, what are we doing here? You know, you're 15. First of all, 15, 16, you got
right,
a gun.
What are you doing out here with a gun?
And you're just shooting. Just, you know, yeah.
Oof. Meanwhile, the cases, the confirmed cases of cyclosporiasis are up to 700 here in the state of Michigan. This gastrointestinal illness causes diarrhea, other symptoms, but now up to 700 cases. It has been climbing steadily every single day. And the health experts believe this stems from produce,
yeah,
fruits, vegetables, berries, lettuce, things like that. And if they're not washed properly or well enough, then all of a sudden you get this in your system. And you're in for a rough go of it for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, the illness can be treated with antibiotics, but you have to go to the doctor when you're feeling bad and, you know, and get these antibiotics. Bactrim, I believe, is the antibiotic that you can take. But normally, on a normal year, we get about 50 of these cases. And now we're up to, you know, 700. So something's happening.
Yeah, something's happening.
Yeah.
And it's again, like, this is where they have to do the tracing. So
yes,
it's, okay, where did you eat?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you buy your groceries?
Mm-hmm.
Where did the grocer get those, you know, tomatoes from
or that lettuce
from?
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to cycle it back. And it can take some time before they figure out maybe where the source is coming from, if there's something wrong at the facility,
yes,
where it's packaged, mm-hmm, where they grow it, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it does take some time. Meanwhile, the cases go.
And they say with the lettuce, you know, they're asking, you know, you, if you want to use lettuce, to buy a whole head of lettuce and wash it, as opposed to buying the bag lettuce.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
Caris LeVert, no longer a Piston. He gets dealt. Gary Harris and Torin Prince are Detroit bound. Gary Harris played his college ball at Michigan State. So we are familiar with Gary Harris, but
yes,
the Prince signing is to me a little more exciting. It gives you a little more size to forward those things. But this was really about cap space, and mm-hmm, they did eliminate some cap space. What that means, this, and by the way, this was a part of a much bigger deal, six-team deal.
Six teams, yeah.
But regardless, they've cleared a little space. What that means, who are they going after, what they want to do, I guess time will tell.
Maybe a big name?
Maybe a big name.
You know, not LeBron. Because LeBron left us off his list.
What a shame.
Are your feelings hurt?
They are crushed.
Something, though, I know you care about.
Yeah.
And I know you were waiting for this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Detroit Lions star wide receiver Amon-Ra St. Brown got engaged.
Oh, good.
to his longtime girlfriend, Brooklyn Adams, in a social media post yesterday, sharing photos of the yacht proposal with the caption, "Hard launch." And he was on one knee, was surrounded by flowers and a sign reading, "Mrs." The announcement drew congratulations from NFL stars, including Falcons receiver Drake London and Bears quarterback Caleb Williams, but not Chris Winwick.
What is it? I look very happy. Very happy for the sun god.
No, they've been.
Maybe he'll rent out Ford Field for a week and prepare for a wedding
and have all the, you know.
God bless. I hope the couple is very happy.
Yeah, they've been knowing each other, man, since, you know, high school. So they've been dating a long time. So
very happy for them.
Going to happen.
Very happy for them. Yeah, also, Tigers get a big win yesterday. They beat the Athletics down at Comerica Park. So
Scooby-Doo.
He pitched really well. I mean, he gave up a couple hits, more than I think he'd like. But regardless, he goes five innings, gave up five hits, one earned run, nine strikes, two walks.
Two walks.
Kind of a mundane two start walks. For him. Yeah. But he kept everybody in check. They win it 6-2. And then game two of that series today. That's a 6:40 first pitch. By the way, just 9 games under 500 at this point.
5 games back in the wild card. Woo! 71 to go. Come on, stay now. Here for more
Don't
wild card
Don't let the Tigers
updates.
Get hot. Come That's on. Exactly right.
Come on.
Called a winning streak.
Do you know enough about the candidates running for office? Because absentee ballots are out. We'll talk about it next. It's JR Morning. Well, as is kind of usual in cases like this, in this part of a calendar in a midterm cycle, you get a lot of sizzle. You get a lot of sizzle, not quite as much steak.
Right.
And should we be getting more steak? I think everybody should. I don't think we've gotten enough, and neither does Andrea Bitely in this piece.
I think we, you know, when it's the primary, you get the sizzle, and you don't really get the steak until November.
Right.
Because everybody's trying to get past the primary.
Yeah. So it's like, are we getting, we're just getting the fluff when we need the real information.
Yeah.
What is your plan? What would you do X, Y, and Z? And we've gotten a little bit of it, of course.
Sure.
But should those running for office
give you more?
Be a little more forthright in how they believe and how they would handle things. And that was the focus of a piece in the Detroit Free Press. It was a written by Republican strategist Andrea Bitely. And yes, we've seen the attack ads. Yes, we've seen the social media posts. But how would you fare on education? Or what do you believe on the war in Iran? Or what? All of these questions need to come to light, especially now that absentee ballots are out and about. Andrea Bitely joins us this morning to talk about her piece. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what is... Again, we're in the primary portion of this. So these candidates are trying to court the voters on their side of the aisle. Does that give them, I guess, carte blanche to take it easier on some of these subjects? They're just trying to get their name out there to garner the most votes.
Yeah, absolutely. They are trying at this moment to just get onto the November ballot. But we have a few races where things are pretty well decided. You have the Republican U.S. Senate race. There's only Mike Rogers running. You have the Democrat primary for governor, where Chris Swan's a good, strong candidate, but Jocelyn Benson is going to be the likely nominee. So I'd like to see some of these candidates that are essentially already going to be on the November ballot really, really give us some actual, here's my plan. And not just some, you know, one-page short piece. I mean a real concrete, this is what I'm going to do to improve education. This is what I'm going to do to improve our business climate.
You're right that campaigns spend more time attacking opponents than explaining the solutions. Is that because the negative campaigning works or because candidates just don't want to be pinned down on specifics?
Is yes. An answer to both of those questions, because that is my answer. You can fundraise a whole lot more when you are out there throwing jabs at your opponent. You can find ways to fund those negative ads a whole lot easier than you can when you're out there talking about actual public policy. But the reality is the Wednesday after the election, someone will have won, and they are going to have to give Michiganders an answer or two pretty quickly as to especially whomever becomes our next governor. They're going to have to set up a government this December. What does that look like? What are their priorities? We have a lot of state departments. Are they going to keep those same departments? Are they going to change them? The Michigan Economic Development Corporation has been, you know, an economic engine, theoretically, for the state of Michigan for 30-plus years. Are they going to continue the MEDC? You know, the legislature just defunded a large portion of the MEDC. Will the next governor work hard to refund it, or will they find a new avenue?
Well, again,
there's a lot of questions.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah.
And this is where the money in the political realm matters. Because if you're in the primary cycle and you can flood the airways, you can flood television, you can flood social media with ads, well, all of a sudden, you're a top of mind for people when they go and cast their primary vote. But aside from that, you talk about the education problem and the population issues here in the state of Michigan. What issue do you think these candidates should be focused on first?
I'd love for more of our candidates to talk about how they're going to improve our education system. Education is a foundational element of what government is responsible for in the state of Michigan. We have a responsibility to give kids the opportunity to succeed. We can't guarantee their success, but we have to give them the tools they need. And companies who are looking for a good location to expand are looking at education as a key component of that. Right now, half, essentially, of Michigan's third graders aren't reading at grade level, and it doesn't improve that much as we go up through to high school. People are really, really struggling, and we have not funded our education programs in a way that is sustainable to make sure that people can achieve big things. And we're also needing people who are not necessarily college educated, but are educated in the trades. You know how hard it is to find a plumber? You know how expensive it is? Well, if we started earlier and we started kids in high school with the opportunity to really accelerate in their apprenticeship, we would have a whole lot more plumbers and pipe fitters and welders out there in the state of Michigan.
You know, you argue that we've, you know, started asking less of our candidates as well. How do we get to a place where debates are becoming more optional instead of expected? I mean, you got front runners skipping debates.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, normally at the Mackinac Policy Conference, you have a gubernatorial campaign, a gubernatorial debate between each of the leading campaigns. We didn't have that this year. And, you know, you haven't seen the front runners, Jocelyn Benson and John James, out there debating their primary opponents quite as much as you've seen in years past. You know, full disclosure, I was working for Mike Duggan on his gubernatorial campaign, and we said yes to a lot of debates that never happened. So I am really somebody who likes to see the candidates talk. Last night in Grand Rapids, the Senate Democrats debated. You had Abdul Al-Sayed and Haley Stevens, but there wasn't much stake, as I believe was started at this conversation. There was a lot of fat, though. There was a lot of bickering, a lot of pointing fingers, yeah. But we didn't really get down to policy. We'll see what happens tonight. Fox 2 is hosting the Republican gubernatorial candidates, and we'll see how deep the questions and answers go.
Andrea Biley, interesting piece in the Detroit Free Press. Thank you for your time. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it. Fascinating stuff. Mm. And again, the more you know, the better off you are. Frontier taking over for Spirit in some capacity. We'll talk about it next. Well, Frontier Airlines is expanding its presence at Detroit Metro after Spirit goes belly up. The new services that were once held by Spirit now include Frontier flights from Detroit to Fort Lauderdale, to Philadelphia and Las Vegas. These are low travel options for people that maybe flew Spirit. Now,
sure.
Frontier filling in some of those gaps. And it's certainly an important market for Frontier to expand in here in Detroit. Let's talk about it. Mary Schiavo is the former Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation and joins us once again. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
How important is it for a company to fill in those gaps when a company like Spirit exits the industry for those options to continue to be in markets like in Detroit?
Well, it's very important because, you know, ever since deregulation of the airlines back in 1978, which was a haphazard, just messy disaster of a procedure anyway, the whole idea is that when one airline ceases to operate routes or goes bankrupt or gets overtaken, that the market will fill in the gaps left by that airline. And so obviously, Frontier believes in the traffic in and out of Detroit, that they will have profitable runs on those routes. And it's also very important for the citizens of Detroit who are, and elsewhere, those of us just south of the border who have to drive to Detroit. You know, it's very important because otherwise you're leaving your citizens without service, as poor Toledo has no commercial airline service, I think one flight a week. And so it's important for the airlines to step into the market and provide the much needed service and hopefully at a reasonable profit to keep the routes going.
You know, Frontier is advertising fares as low as $49. You know, the airline industry has become famous for unbundling everything and from seat assignments to carry-on bags. Are today's low fares, you know, are they really a bargain once all the extra fees are added in?
Well, it depends who you ask. Now, economists have had tried to look to see if, you know, the way airlines acted literally since 1978, since deregulation, whether it really did deliver savings to consumers. And on certain routes, the answer is yes, they were. But these are on highly trafficked, high competition routes. So on routes where there's a lot of competition, yes, economists, experts will say that, you know, some savings was delivered to consumers. But in a free market free-for-all where you have routes that, you know, may not have competition on them, then the jury's out. They don't see a lot of savings. And then the other problem is, and the government's supposed to keep an eye on this and not allow it, but it's predatory pricing. When one airline moves in and they see a route that's underserved, or they serve a route with nonstop service that other carriers may be only serving with hub and spoke, then the bigger carriers with the hub and spoke then move in and try to force the smaller carrier. And in particular, I'm talking about Breeze Airlines, which has had great success on its routes. But, you know, other carriers have added routes to, you know, try to compete head-to-head with them, have put on a couple nonstops. And, you know, it just depends how the market shakes out. But I think whenever you have additional service into your city, that's a plus.
Well, and then to your point, and Lloyd mentioned these low introductory fares, the concern is that, okay, Spirit goes away. That was one of the budget airlines. Now Frontier is going to fill in that gap. Are they going to raise prices? And whether they break it down into seat assignments or baggage fees, whatever, if those airfares go up, all of a sudden you don't have those budget airlines anymore.
Well, that's right. And that's what has happened on many of the other, you know, started out to be lower costs. There's no such thing as a low-cost carrier. Their costs are the same. Gas is the same. Mm-hmm. Airplanes are the same. What they are lower fare airlines. And, you know, the a la carte pricing is what they call it. The a la carte pricing gets mixed reviews. I mean, some people say, look, if I don't have a checked bag, I don't need to pay for it. Or if I don't care, if I sit in the middle seat, I don't want to pay for it. Some people actually like the a la carte pricing. But, you know, as studies have shown over the last decade or so in the airlines, that's where the airlines raked in tons of profits, and that was all these add-on fares. So it's obviously not a fare that represents a real cost to the airline if that's where the airline showed that's what where their income is coming from bag fees and change fees and all those sorts of things. So, yes, I mean, what usually happens, now I'm not saying Frontier will do this, but what usually happens is once they move in with the introductory fares and get established, fares go up. Mm-hmm. And one airline in particular, Delta, Ed Bastian, the CEO, was already on, I think he was on CNBC, and he said that he did not expect that, you know, everybody raised the prices because of gas. And he did not expect, and I'm paraphrasing, these are not his exact words, but he did not expect that they would be then reducing the fares. So once we see a fare increase, even if gas goes down, jet fuel goes down, we might not see those fares go back down.
And Mary, you know, as a former inspector general, I know you spent years looking at aviation safety and, and oversight. Should passengers ever worry that airlines competing aggressively on price might cut corners somewhere else?
Well, Well, yes. And I actually got in, you know, in the D.C. and the D.C. swamp. Nobody liked hearing this. But, you know, we did look at that. And, for example, I had a major, when I was inspector general, a major criminal case going against one airline, now out of business. But they were pencil whipping their, meaning that they were saying they did the repairs and didn't, pencil whipping their maintenance records. Another major carrier was using bogus parts suppliers. And then finally, the famous one, the one I wrote a book about, a famous low-cost carrier, was ValueJet. And before they crashed, we had documented instances of wires hanging in the plane, you know, things going wrong. There was a previous tragedy.
Wow.
And they did cut corners on maintenance. And that was, you know, a direct, you know, part of the direct result of ValueJet going away.
Mm. Mary Scalvo, interesting stuff as always. Thanks for your insight. We appreciate you. We'll talk again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
I mean, I like a low-cost fare, but I want to make sure the plane can get me there, too. I don't want them to, you know, cut a corner on maintenance and those types of things because my fare is cheaper.
You know what's funny is I kind of look at these airlines like I look at anything else in my life. Like, there are things where I don't care what I have. Like, it doesn't matter what brand it is or anything. Like,
yeah.
But in my house, we are a Heinz ketchup family. My wife's...
no other kind.
My wife's grandfather worked for Heinz.
Okay.
That's it. We are Heinz. We are a Jiffy peanut butter family.
Okay.
Period, end of story.
Gotcha.
Most everything else I don't really care about.
Okay, but Jiffy and Heinz.
It's and I tend to feel that way with
airlines
too.
Yeah.
Like, I generally gravitate towards Delta.
Me too.
Now, sometimes Delta doesn't have the flight that I need.
That's right.
Or they have a layover, and I don't want to be stuck in Newark for
six hours.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want it.
Exactly.
So I'll go somewhere else. But for the most part, I pretty much fly Delta.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So it's like, but it's funny how that bleeds over into, we have to have this, and we're flying Delta. And if it doesn't work, I guess we'll capitulate and go somewhere else and figure it out. But. Yeah. But I think most people are probably like that too, unless the cost is just so vastly different. You're like, well, I got to go to Fort Lauderdale anyway. Might as well do it for $50.
But you're right. Yeah. Yeah. But I also want to make sure that, you know,
I got to make
a plane. I'd get like me there for $50.
Exactly right. Coming up on the other side of Wednesday, time for Name That Tune. It's next, the JR Morning.